there are certain corporate aspects of the two concepts that are similar, so that the idea of communal property and the private property as expressed in corporations law, there are some similarities. So it may be a very appropriate vehicle to use. At this point, I don't say yes or no. The focus of this discussion now and to continue is to try to look at what it is, where we came from, and why it is we need a special period of time to consider where it is that we're going. And when we do decide where it is that we're going, what kind of components do you look at to make a decision on what it is that you want to do? If I have a concern right now, and I like the effort that the AFN is making and the natives as a whole are making in the resolutions, what my concern is that in this move to try to determine our own destinies, that we reduce the scope of our options and don't consider what it is and why it is that we want something to change. It's very easy to look at the end results and hire attorneys like myself to go ahead and work on fancy little proposals for solutions. But in order to get there, you've got to try to consider what it is, what are the components of your decision. Yes, I was on a corporate board myself. I advise many corporations, so I know the technical problems you have to live with day to day. But I think that you're not going to get real, firm, satisfactory, long-term solutions unless you do look at some of these other issues that aren't considered in day-to-day corporate management. What it is that causes a conflict in me and you, the other native shareholder. I own private property, but then again, I'm a tribal member. My tribe doesn't happen to own property right now. A corporation does. I now have the right, derivatively, to determine what happens with that property. I've got conflict in myself that there is this appreciation of private property rights. I get a dividend every year. There's other shareholders who don't. So I mean, I'm even enticed more than others are. I happen to belong to a fairly successful regional corporation and a village at that. So there is that side. But what about the other side of me that says that I want to share, that I know that perhaps I didn't live under I didn't live for a long period of time under a tribal government where those kinds of restrictions are and that kind of style of life where you do not have the right to alienate the property, that rather there is a sense of sharing. There's a sense of being able to use, but the idea of actually owning yourself and taking it away isn't there. A tribal member can leave, but he doesn't replace himself with someone else. A shareholder in a corporation leaves. That alone wouldn't be bad. What happens, though, is that he replaces himself with someone else. And the corporate tribe has no, at this point, doesn't have the ability to determine who that someone else is. Under a communal land ownership system, you don't replace yourself. You don't diminish the interest in the property that the tribe has. You don't diminish the control over that property. That, I'm trying to express, is really a core concern, an ideological side to 1991. I want to tie it in a little bit more with the resolutions. The resolutions right now, they do provide one provision for the villages to be able to look towards a different entity, essentially to put it into a membership corporation or some kind of a communal holding is what the result is most of the time. For the most part, the other provisions look towards keeping a corporate form and having various levels of restriction on the alienability of stock or the various levels of being able to keep control over the corporation through accepted means that are even in the state laws right now, although in some situations, particularly with regard to derivative rights, the dissenting rights, that there is the need to get some authority to eliminate those. I mean, not all states have dissenting rights. It's a statutory provision in most situations. What I see happening, though, and perhaps you see it differently, I want to hear, that there's a tendency to polarize the solutions. That is, to put them all into one category or the other. Sure, if you want communal land holdings, fine. Go form a tribe, incorporate a nonprofit, get a trust together, do something. Or the opposite side is keep with a corporation, keep with individual property rights, and live with it as it is, with perhaps some variations. Now, there's still conflict there. There's still this need to maintain control, perhaps not for these kind of ideological reasons, but maybe there are other reasons also for wanting to remain in control of a corporation that aren't inconsistent with private property rights. People simply want to keep in control. My point is that even that isn't really the stance of most natives, I don't think. Whether they are in a village, in a very tribal area, a very rural setting, versus being in the middle of a city. Even urban people, or even those people out there, share one or the other of these interests. They have these feelings, these inherent feelings of this communal nature. And then again, there's also the familiarity with private property rights. We have both of them in us. And yet the decisions and the choices that we have ask us to choose one or the other. I don't see enough options that look towards a melding or finding an accommodation of the two. And this is where I get into my point that I think that a long-term solution that's satisfactory will look at those combinations of interests that we have inside of us and try to find a way of expression in law that allows for them. I don't know if that's going to come about. I didn't come in talking about the resolutions or these particular proposals. I mean, an attorney typically wants to do that because he gets paid for working on them later. I may be unfair to you because what I'm asking you to do may cost you more money because you are going to have to look deeper. And I think that if you don't find something that's satisfactory, that matches those inner feelings that we have, that you're going to have dissatisfaction personally and inside of people. They're not going to like living with what they have. So that's really the substance of what I have to say and what the substance of what the paper is. There's more technical points on what are the aspects of private property, what are the aspects of tribal land holdings. Accommodation has been practiced by the natives throughout this period of land claims. It started with the task force where we had to find what other people could live with to allow us to get a land claims. I think that we are now going to have to look at accommodation among natives themselves to find out what it is that each one of us is going to be able to live with in a solution to 1991. And that it's not only, and that it shouldn't only be focused on what are the nice solutions that are available to us, the nice components that we can talk about to fit in, and expect just each one of us to make a personal decision on what's there. If you don't look at what's there, you're going to limit the choices that are available to us. You're going to eliminate this idea of destiny. You're going to be forcing things down people's throats that don't fit what's inside of them. So, does self-determination really, in its pure sense, this idea that people decide on their own, whether individually or in groups, does it have some application? Can it act as a philosophy to guide us that goes beyond simply what our balance sheet says? Is there something that we can find that will help us in making these decisions? Tom?
Well, thanks, Bart. That was a very thoughtful introduction to the subject. I think we might spend a little more time discussing generally some of the questions that Bart has raised. And if I may ask Monroe Price perhaps to to go next. You might offer some of your reflections on it as an historian and lawyer with wide knowledge of what measures Congress has taken in the lower 48 prior to ANCSA. Anyway, perhaps we could move to you then.
Thank you. I thought Bart's paper was very thought-provoking and raises some very important questions. I'd like to say first, and this is something we'll turn to tomorrow, the resolutions of the AFN may provide the opportunity for lots of options. I think one of the real questions that has to be probed is how many options can be built within the context that have been that has been set forth by the AFN resolutions. And to what extent will those options be sensitive to the competing values that you describe? Let me say a word first about self-determination. It seems to me that there are major steps in self-determination, and then there is implementation of those steps to see how they work out. One could ask oneself whether the 1971 Act was an act of self-determination by Alaska Natives. That is to say, did Alaska Natives have an opportunity, moving aside for the moment of how they expressed it, how they communally decided the question, was there some consensus among Alaska Natives in 1971 that our act of self-determination is to seek from Congress the kind of structure which Congress imposed? You could then criticize the act and say it doesn't provide enough decision-making, it leans more to the corporate side, it's not self-determination in an abstract platonic sense, but it may be self-determination in the act of a community saying, this is what we want. It's like saying the Constitution of the United States is imperfect. It doesn't provide enough democracy. There is not enough one man, one vote in the United States Senate. But it was an act of self-determination that said, this is our option for the political system and the structure that we wish to have. So there are two different kinds of self-determination questions. One is, when a group decides, this is what we want, whatever the content of that, is that self-determination, as opposed to taking a look at what it is they end up with and say, does that meet some other range of expectations, proper or improper? So here we have the 1971 Act, and one can ask quite legitimately, was there enough of a consensus? Was there enough consultation? Was it a legitimate act of self-determination itself? And there may be differing opinions about that, but that seems to me to be one integrity question. That is to say, if this was something that was generally agreed upon in some not vote plebiscite way, but in some other another sense, is that the act of self-determination? And then the criticism of the federal legislation takes different shapes. How do we perfect it? How do we improve it? How do we modify it, et cetera? But you would then take the position that the natives had, community had somehow done something that was reflective of their own views. Now, 1991 may provide another opportunity. It's sometimes fortunate to have recurring opportunities organically to say, here is self-determination in action. And the 1991 visitation of this question may be another opportunity to do that. On the self-determination issue as well, it seems to me that it is true that there could be something which one would call pure self-determination, in which there are no external binds, but that's obviously difficult to get. If you take the Navajo tribe, it is subject to some extent to federal legislation, to environmental protection legislation, to state law, and there is a working out of what these relations will be as part of the definition of what makes a tribe, as it were. So I'm, again, the very makeup of what constitutes self-determination is complex. But I think more important is the organic act of a community saying, here's what we want. It's like the Micronesia negotiations with the United States government or other entity, other examples like that. The other thing I'd like to address a couple of points. One is what might be called continuity and discontinuity in community structure. One question which I would have, and maybe Rosita Worrell or other anthropologists could talk about this, is the extent to which there has been experienced discontinuity between 1971 and the present over what went before. That is to say, one could develop a model of Alaska Native history in which there were many different kinds of community organizations that adapted in different ways to different circumstances, with different senses of property rights, different senses of the relationship between individuals and the group, etc. That 1971 was an occasion for change and maybe substantial change, but not necessarily discontinuity. That what makes people apprehensive about 1991 is that it presents the formidable likelihood of discontinuity as well as change. And the reason for that would be that I suppose the way one looks at change is how external forces mold what occurs within a community. Those can be economic changes, like the coming of the settler community from the lower 48 or from Russia. It can be economic factors, like changes in fishing rights or fishing, or the changes in the quantity of the fishery or the discovery of oil. It also can be structural changes, like the 1971 Act itself. But some of those are more formidable in their impact on a community than others. It may well be that the power to sell stock and the ability of non-natives to purchase stock, what is supposed to occur in 1991, is a discontinuity and change aspect rather than merely change. So it's something that needs to be looked at. One of the things that I would suggest is that perhaps there has been less discontinuity in the last 20 years than we might otherwise think about. And I'm not sure what the right answer to that is. One certainty is that different people emerged as leaders because different skills were necessary in the post-1971 period from the pre-1971 period. But that also may happen to a community when there are certain kinds of external changes. In terms of this question of change, however, prior to the 1971 Act, maybe even prior to the 1936 amendments to the Indian Reorganization Act, you had what I would call organic differentiation among Native communities. That is to say, no one was saying to a Native community, here's how you can change and here are the limitations on it. It was, and this may be fictive, but I'll say it's organic. That is to say, different communities changed in different ways. And they had different senses of the role of the individual and property rights. I'll bet that there were very different senses among coastal groups and inland groups with respect to property rights and things like that, having to do with something other than structure that's outside. In distinction to this organic differentiation, we now have, under the Native Claims Settlement Act, something which is, I would call superimposed similarities. That is, that you've got, everybody's got to march to certain kinds of, to the same drummer in some way. And it may be that that's not necessarily, that isn't even not necessarily the case under the Act, and it certainly may not be the case under amendments. Let me give a couple of examples of that. On the question of the status of village corporations had the option in 1971 of being either profit corporations or nonprofit corporations. All village corporations chose to be profit corporations. For some reason, which has some historic basis, which I don't know, this similarity was imposed rather than options, although the options were available. Anyway, and there are probably other examples where there are options in governance structure that that could be used even now, but so that even with this superimposed similarity, different structures are developing and probably can develop. The third point I would make is that, and this arose in a McDonald's discussion between me and Ralph Johnson this morning, and that is that we discuss structural issues and not distribution questions mostly. That is to say, how should tribes be organized or how should corporations be organized, but not how should wealth be distributed? And one of the things that I think people are becoming more sensitive to as 1991 approaches is distribution of wealth as opposed to management and accumulation of wealth by the entity. And here the native, the elders issue arises, the unborn issue arises, the non-registered issue arises, dividends, a number of other questions which could generally be lumped in the question of, okay, here's an act that's been passed. The issue, it's true, one issue is organizations and decision making, but another issue is how is wealth redistributed and how should decisions be made concerning redistribution of wealth? And that may be different from the tribe corporation question. Finally, I just thought I'd say that in 1991, as I mentioned, what looks like might occur is more in the way of external forces, that is to say, without passage of a statute. And this is what's making people apprehensive. And one of the questions is, how do you decide the extent to which these external forces should come in? It's a luxury that we don't always have, and we may not have it now. That is to say, the world is filled with external forces that impinge on community life. This looks like one that is very forceful and about which decisions can be made. And I suppose that a lot of the 1991 exercise is about decision making concerning that external force. I think I'll stop there.
Do you want to chime in at this point, Charlie? Or?
Yes, I think a couple of points that I think we really need to discuss, and as we approach 1991, and looking back at the Act, we really see that the imposition of corporations on Native people, I think, individualizes our expectations rather than the communal, and this is what part of the thing that Bart was talking about, and that the imposition of the American ideal, I think, of individual rights over communal rights, you know, really is or could be a major block in our efforts at changing for 1991. And I really think and that we must do something about that particular right that we have expectations about, that the stock rights or the stockholder rights, as they're now stated in corporations, gives us as Native people some expectations of individual economic benefits that perhaps were absent in a communal, traditional communal setting, and that expectation of individual betterment. I think we must deal with that in some way in reverting back, if it's our desire to revert back to some more traditional communal setting, whether it's a tribe or whatever, and that we must address that particular question, whether it's in federal legislation or state legislation that our expectations and our reversion back to a communal feeling or participation in a communal body, if we're going to fall back on that and utilize that deep feeling, I think is what we might call it, or whatever, of membership in a native community, then the corporate structure and the rights that it gives us must be dealt with. And that's really, really important. I think in reassessing or looking back on what has happened with the Alaska Native corporations, and the thing that Monroe mentioned about the needs for different skills, if we look back, I think the leadership of the corporations has been developed, and those that were leaders because of political skills rather than other skills that you might find in a corporation. And the result of that is you see with corporations not performing as well, perhaps, because the feeling of the leadership that they're a political body rather than a corporate body, I think, caused us those, you know, caused the problems within the corporations. And I think now that we're reaching a different level of skill or choosing of leadership, other than for political skills that we did at first. Now, in looking toward 1991, I really think that we need to look at the Land Claims Act and ask us, did the Land Claims Act afford us the opportunity to achieve what we want to achieve, irregardless of how we phrase it or what we come up with? And the answer, I think, is going to be yes, it will afford us that opportunity. And if the Land Claims Act can be graded, I think, in the end, on that, on whether or not it really did give us the opportunity toward self-determination, then we might view it, I think, in a different light. The problems that we've been looking at lately seems to emphasize what's wrong with the Land Claims Act. And I think if we look at it in a different light, that it does afford us, and it will afford us the opportunity toward achieving that self-determination that we so longingly look for, then we're going to look at the Act, I think, in a different light.
Thanks, Charlie. Bart, did anything that Monroe or Charlie said prompt anything you want to respond to, or?
Yes, in part. That is, my idea of identifying what we have inside of us to find out where we go doesn't speak to either side. I'd think we could concede that all of us have both, and the point that Charlie makes is well taken, that we have created expectations of individual gain out of ANCSCA. I mean, and that existed before. I mean, it was part of what motivated us to get to move towards a Claim Settlement Act. And as I've stated in the, as far as the task force, that natives probably got really close to what they went in looking for. So what Monroe said, that is, they look for something, they managed to get it, and it came within the restrictions of what everyone usually has to live with in society. And that is that there is a Congress, there is a state law, there is a federal law, there are limitations in what people can do, so that you can't get a pure self-determination. There's one other thing, and that is that I'd like, it's not really my idea, but what in reading through the volumes of things that Tom has sent me, I saw a number of interesting comments, and Borbridge makes this one point about 1991 as an opportunity to reevaluate and perhaps to give some leverage to those who haven't been heard before, because it does, 1991 does signal a time when there may come tumultuous change for that impacts both sides, those of the issue, if you look at it as a full spectrum and all of us being in between, of how it will affect us individually, how it will affect us communally. Look at it as a means of getting corporations that better reflect what we each have, whether if you happen to be in an area where you want that to be a pure business machine, that's fine. But to use that time to get changes that make that entity, whatever it is, work better for you, so that it is an opportunity, and that it's good that you do have 1991 on one side, that it is good that there is time to reconsider. If we didn't have that, you may have had simply entrenched power that went on forever, wherever it happened to lay.
Would anyone over there like to say something? Glenn Fredericks, Marlene Johnson?
I would like to comment on what Price Monroe said about why we had two. One was nonprofit, and I incorporated a lot of villages in the Bethel region when in corporations and so forth, and explaining what, and surprisingly the attorney that we had didn't explain to us what the difference were. And I kind of regret that we didn't look more into that nonprofit status, because you can always take out a piece of land if you were to make a business deal, I think in my mind, from the profit a nonprofit corporation, and make that a business enterprise. And what Charlie said, I believe we're in the right track now. It used to be that we elected our native officials in political, more so in political light than the business. We're, I think, reverting now to the business sense, and let politics maybe to the nonprofit, so forth.
I'd like to ask Glenn, Mr. Fredericks, whether, I don't know why this isn't working, that's all right. Doesn't matter. Oh, okay. Whether you think that some of the village corporations should have the option to that they had in 1971, but exercise it the other way. That is, say, would one possible solution to some villages be to go from the profit corporation mode to the nonprofit corporation mode?
Yes, I think there should be, and I think there is a way, and maybe a little later on I'll explain what we're doing. We're one of the 10 villages that merged in the Kuskokwim area into one corporation, put all our assets and land into one corporation. And I believe there is a way under state corporate laws, different corporations, co-ops and so forth, I think that should be looked at. We are. I know AFN is looking at a federal side, but I think we should be looking on state level, and maybe some of these corporations and associations and so forth can be changed for the better of the native community.
Yeah, Bart Garber.
I don't want to abuse the position I've managed to get here, but. There was one other thing, and I've only heard of it by second hand because I deal with the question sometimes, and perhaps Glenn, you or others who actually were the incorporators that time, there have been some concerns that it may not have been an absolute free choice that was available. I've heard that at times that there were some concerns with the distributions that were required under ANCSCA, that some attorneys may have advised that a nonprofit didn't have the powers under the state corporate laws to do that, and thus the nonprofit was a no option, that in fact wasn't an option, because they couldn't give out money to share their members. Now that may have been a wrong position to take, because you may have been able to say that the federal law that said it could happen displaced whatever the state said, but that may not have been the opinion that was given to a client. So I don't know. If someone has some direct comment on that, I'd like to hear it.
Yeah. I believe you're right, because we were told that we couldn't distribute like dividends under the program. I guess you can't, being not being an attorney, I don't know. But that was what we were told at that time. that we couldn't distribute it, and everybody figure we're gonna, as natives, get a lot of money now and all the land. We figure we're gonna get, we gotta have some entity distribute that stuff, you know. And I think there was a mistake. I really believe it now that we should have gone nonprofit.
David Case.
One point. And this has come up before. The state, and I don't, and I am an attorney, but I don't know that I have the answer. But the state in 1972 did amend the nonprofit corporate code with just a short paragraph to specifically permit corporations to organize as nonprofits, as ANCSA corporations or as village corporations to organize as nonprofits. Now, this doesn't specify, and I don't recall the exact site right now, much less the language. It does not quite specify that these corporations will be able to make distributions, but you could probably argue pretty cogently that they do, since the Claims Act requires the distributions to be made.
Well, maybe this is an example of individual right. Maybe it isn't a legal prohibition, but an example of individual rights versus collective rights. One could have said maybe that if you organized as a nonprofit, you could give out, you could provide benefits to people who were beneficiaries of the nonprofit, who would be broader than the shareholders. That one of the benefits of a nonprofit was that it could benefit people unborn, it could give out dissimilar benefits to individuals, etc. So I guess if you asked that group called shareholders of a village corporation, did they want a choice in which a larger group of people could be benefited and benefits could be dissimilar among beneficiaries, or did they want to be the sole beneficiaries and did they want it to be automatic, it might be that they would automatically choose the profit-making route. Or if it's explained that way, that might have been what occurred.
Right. And I think, I mean, nobody really knows what happened, right. I guess. But what I guess you just said, Glenn, was that you were advised that you could not make the distributions, the judgment for the fund distributions from the Native Fund.
That may be
assume.
True, too, yeah.
And that, if that was correct advice, well, fine. If it wasn't correct advice, then, of course, that the
right.
option you just mentioned was really eliminated.
Right.
Did you want to say something, Drew?
Sure.
Drew Hageman.
This is in part a response, I guess, to the issues that Bart has raised, and I think that some of the issues that are built into our discussion through these days. I'd like to just raise the issue of the definition of control that has been mentioned a few times and is, I think, is underlying some of the discussion today. I think when we've talked about control today, we've focused on kind of the organizational or structural basis of control. We've looked at structural forms of control. We've talked about alternatives to the corporate form, tribal forms. The issue I guess I'd like to raise is that there's another aspect of control that needs to be addressed, and it's probably the individual-based form of control, issues of expertise and skills and abilities. On the one hand, we can have some agreement or develop a consensus on what kinds or forms of structure ought to be put in place to remedy some of the problems that have been identified. It's one thing, however, to reach some kind of ideological agreement. It's another thing to make it happen. I guess I'm concerned as a professor in a school of management, I'm concerned about the skills and the capacities, particularly of Native people, to make these organizational forms, regardless of what form we're talking about, happen and work effectively. I guess there's a corollary to that, another piece to it. On the one hand, I'm understanding that the for-profit Native corporations are doing a better job, that Native managers are developing the kinds of skills that have been talked about that permit effectiveness from a corporate perspective to go forward. My concern is this, and I suppose we'll have some opportunities to talk about it in greater detail later, but that very success in being successful with the for-profit form may in fact be pulling the pins out from alternative forms. We may be diverting, first of all, some of our best Native talent to the for-profit corporations. we may be taking those and continue to take those away from village and nonprofit corporations, making them less viable. On the other hand, as we look at the kinds of skills that we're providing for those who run the for-profit corporations, those skills are not necessarily those skills that are consistent or congruent with some of the values that we've talked about here today. The communal approach. We talk about going back to a communal approach. We may talk about going back, but we are not putting the skills in the hands of the native managers and native people to make that a reality. What we are rewarding in our system now is a Western-style structure. What we're rewarding in terms of success among Native leaders is a Western form. And I recognize there are many, many examples where Native for-profit corporations have been able to deal successfully in bridging the gap. But my concern is, for the long term, our ability to provide skills and to indeed implement alternate forms if we want to consider those.
Charlie Johnson.
Yeah, I'd like to just address that point briefly. I don't really have the same concerns for the ability of the Native people to manage or address the changes. Because if you look at what we've done in the last few years, we've gone from a communal, generally rural, uneducated position to where we're many of our people are accomplished corporate leaders. And, you know, we've done that since 1971, and that's only a few years ago. I think what that really points out is the adaptability of Native people. And, you know, I listened to an old person in one of our villages, and we were discussing the fish and game laws. And one of the biologists said, well, you guys talk about how you traditionally did things, and maybe we should make this the rules about taking game traditional. So he said that means you couldn't use rifles and all the modern conveniences. And one of the elders said, no, that's not what we're talking about. And he says, well, what is the traditional way of hunting in your village? And the old man responded. He said, the traditional way is the most efficient way. And he said, if it's more efficient to take game with a rifle, then that's traditional. And I think that speaks to the adaptability of our Native people, that we are very adaptable. And we will be able to manage the changes that 1991 will bring about. And I think the process that we're going through within the regions and at AFN is really aimed at managing that change, to have the Native people manage the change as it comes about, and hopefully, as I mentioned earlier, realize some of the expectations that we have created, or that have been created or raised, not only individually but as a community.
Could I say something about that, and then I'll call on Elizabeth Johnson. It's worth bearing in mind that, as far as I know, there has been no settlement of Native land claims closely resembling ANCSA. That is, no settlement that set up shareholders' corporations. The Menominee settlement set up shareholders' corporations, but the period of the period when the shares were not transferable was postponed, and eventually they were restored. So that doesn't constitute a real precedent. But what Congress did was they said, you are all shareholders now, and you have a form of private property known as a share in a corporation, and you do not, as a tribe, own this land anymore. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that the Alaska Native tribes owned all the land, that they were tribes and they owned all the land, so we don't spend time talking about that. They said, you now have a form of private property like all other investors in America, and here it is, and Congress obviously intended that in 20 years' time those shares would go on the market and that people would sell their shares and get money or money's worth and use the money to buy snow machines or fix up their houses or buy other shares, buy shares in General Motors, that native ancestral lands would, after 1991, become part of the, would become mingled with the lands of the privately held in lands in Alaska generally, and that there would be nothing distinctive after 1991 about native corporations. They would just be corporations with some native shareholders, some non-native shareholders, and that was clearly the intention. Now, no other settlement that I'm aware of, either before or since, adopted that particular method of settling the claim. And we're in a situation where, as far as I can tell, and no one here is disputing it, as far as I can tell, Native people in Alaska are saying, well, we don't want that outcome. We don't want nature to take its course. We don't want to see the land that we hold, that we always held in common, and that is now held by corporations. We don't want to see that land fall into non-native hands. That is the theme of what I've been hearing in the villages. They feel that land should be passed on from one generation to the next. Yet, as Charlie Johnson says, and I thought the way he put it sums up the dilemma. Bart adverted to this. There is an expectation of individual benefit. People out there are holding shares. Some of them, like Bart, who's a shareholder of Siri and Tionic, I guess, he's been getting dividends. I don't know how much, but a lot of those places, people haven't been getting dividends. And like human beings everywhere, they can't help thinking that maybe in 1991, these shares will be worth something, and I will finally get something out of this claim, because the idea of cash has always been regarded as part of this claim. And